Blog Talk Radio.
Hi guys, this is Jessica English with The Bottom Line with Jessica English, and I'm calling in today from a rainy St. Paul, Minnesota. I want to welcome you all to the show, and I'll just start off with a little introduction here. In the second half of our show, we'll be joined by Hans Lambert. He is a man who immigrated to the U.S. from Haiti at age 10. But first, I have a question for you. Have you ever had a change of heart? If so, think back to that moment. How did it go? Well, today is Father's Day, and most of us past the age of 25 can probably remember the pivotal moment in our lives when we realized how right our parents were about certain things. And moments like that in my life when I had a change of heart are a mixture of many feelings. And for me, they are usually marked by confusion, bewilderment, disbelief, sometimes anger, sometimes relief. Well, our first guest today had more of a change of mind, in my opinion, from what I've read, than a change of heart. From what I've read, it seems that he stuck with his heart, but in any case, his change came quite publicly with a very well-reasoned and concise argument in a column that you might have seen passed around on Facebook entitled, Why I Gave Up Being a Republican. And you probably saw it everywhere else. So if you had a chance to read it, please give us a call. Call us with your always insightful and interesting questions and comments. The number is 646-929-2495. Our guest today is Michael Stafford. Give us your brief comments or questions for Michael. He'll only be joining us for half hour, so it would be great if you can limit your questions and comments to about 30 seconds. If you're a Republican, I would love for you to join us and give us an idea if you're seeing more people wavering these days or if Michael is just an aberration. We are interested in healthy discussions here at The Bottom Line. We leave the posturing and the salesmanship and incivility for other outlets. So please have a point of view, but also let us be civil towards one another. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation and discussion today with Michael Stafford, the author of the column that you probably saw this week, Why I Gave Up on Being a Republican, the number to call is 646-929-2495. So Michael Stafford is the author of An Upward Calling and was a Republican starting in elementary school. As an adult, he didn't just vote. He was actively involved in the GOP and became an officer, helping his party grow. He has written other commentaries as well, and after the show, you can read a selection of his articles that I posted at the Bottom Line Scoop page. If you'd like to find out more, it's scoop.it/the-bottom-line. Michael Stafford, thank you for joining us today. Not only is it a happy Father's Day to you, but it's also your daughter's 7th birthday. So thank you very much for joining us this morning on The Bottom Line, or this afternoon. Are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, Jessica. Hello? Hello?
Hey, Michael. My name is Janine Mountain, and I'm Jessica's co-host today. And Jessica's been having technical difficulties, so please carry on.
Okay. I'm definitely glad to be here on the show. And as Jessica mentioned, you know, I came to a decision very recently to leave or to switch my registration from Republican to unaffiliated. Here in Delaware, we have a sort of an odd independent party. So the preferred course, if you want to be truly independent, is to go unaffiliated. So I went from R to U, and I decided to write about it. And the column got a good bit of attention. It was on MSNBC. It was picked up and written about by David Frum and Andrew Sullivan. And so it generated a lot of response. I mean, I've been writing op-eds for probably about two and a half years, both in local newspapers and then also abroad over in Australia. And I've never gotten as much of a response as this one generated. I mean, I'm talking maybe 350 to maybe 400 emails from readers who both saw it on MSNBC and then also read about it in their local papers. And the response was overwhelmingly, overall, pretty positive. I think a lot of people, it touched, I think, on some feelings and some emotions that a lot of people share. And, you know, as Jessica mentioned in the intro, I've been a lifelong Republican. I remember very vividly as a fourth grader campaigning on behalf of Ronald Reagan in our fourth grade elementary school class because I was just so determined. Walter Mondale was not going to win the fourth grade class in Kimmerer Elementary School.
Mondale is a great Minnesotan. This is Jess.
Well,
I'm back.
He carried Minnesota in D.C. And you know, I was that kid. It was almost like sports. You know, you're watching the elections, and you know, and maybe at the time I had few friends. I had a lot of time on my hands, but I remember being very into it and watching the map turn red as state after state went for Reagan. It just seemed like everything was right in the universe, and so. Like I said in the column, you know, I've done a lot more than just being a straight ticket voter. I've been very active in the party pretty much throughout my life, helping candidates, running Republican clubs at the colleges I attended, so being supportive of conservative causes, and then ultimately in 2008, becoming a party official here in Delaware and then doing that for about 2 years. So it's a big part of my background. It was definitely – you know, it's been a huge component of my own identity.
I have a question on that. I spent this morning helping at my church, and I'm sorry my phone call was dropped. That does happen. Unfortunately, Janine Loudon is with us to pick up if I drop off. So
it's always had me on mute. That's what I thought.
Anyway. Fortunately, we do have such wonderful volunteers here, and we all work together to make this happen. So anyway, I spent this morning helping out at my church with our worship service, reading the prayers and responses, and I know from reading your articles on income inequality and your response to Rick Warren that you're a practicing Catholic.
Yep.
And it seems the message of the current GOP conflicts with some of your religious beliefs. Do you feel the two have always conflicted, or was there a specific time when you noticed that the two messages really began to wrestle with one another in your mind?
No, there was a specific time. Well, when you're a kid and you're involved in politics and you're interested in public affairs, you're not always thinking about some of the deeper, the deeper philosophical underpinnings of the ideas that people are putting forth. But for me, really, the first crack, if you will, the first break between me and sort of the standard Republican line on an issue really was immigration reform in, what was it, 06 or 07, when President Bush really launched his push for comprehensive immigration reform. I was a big supporter of that. I thought it was not only the right thing to do, but from a political standpoint, I thought it was the right move for the Republican Party in terms of positioning itself to grow moving forward into the future. And I was shocked, just absolutely shocked, at the dehumanizing rhetoric that was directed at immigrants during that sort of 6 to 9 month period where the issue was really in the foreground. It was a preview, I think, of what we saw later on in Arizona and in Alabama and in Georgia. But that was really the first moment where I found myself publicly on the other side of an issue from from sort of the mainstream conservative opinion and having to kind of stake out that place of opposition. And I did come to it partly, you know, for religious reasons. I mean, any practicing Christian knows that, you know, the Holy Family fled Herod's terror into Egypt. And they may not have crossed the Rio Grande, but, you know, Christianity there is a history of a deep respect and the deep importance of welcoming the stranger. That was really the first break. And then other issues kind of piled on top of that. But it started with immigration reform.
Did that specific issue, immigration reform, inform your final decision?
Yes and no. Because by the end, the number of breaks had just grown so numerous. And no, but you know, ironically enough, it did in a roundabout way. In 2009, I had the opportunity and the honor to go down to D.C. With Reverend Luis Cortez's group, Esperanza, to lobby our senators and congressmen on behalf of in support of immigration reform. And in the course of those meetings, there was a group of probably about 20 of us that were down there, mainly pastors and religious leaders. And one of the pastors was from a church in Miami. And he told a very powerful story about a young member of his congregation who, in the 2008 elections, was very conflicted because in terms of, you know, he was a conservative young man. He thought McCain lined up better with his view on a number of issues, but he was very uncomfortable with the tone and the tenor of the rhetoric in the modern, you know, Republican Party and conservative movement. And so he was deeply conflicted about who he was going to vote for, McCain or Obama. And the pastor who was telling the story said, you know, in the end, the young man came to him and said, you know, I ended up voting for Obama because I can't be part of a party that hates me. And that story has always stuck with me because, first, what rational political organization would ever want to put a voter in that kind of a position? But it was powerfully told, it was moving, and it really sums up a lot of what's wrong, I think, with the conservative movement today. So I internalized it, and I've told it a number of times. Well, I'm out having a few drinks with a friend, and happened to be telling that story again probably for the 15th time to him. And he just kind of looked at me across the table. He said, Mike, you know, they hate you too. And it was one of those things that's so glaringly obvious, but, you know, I hadn't really thought of that. I said, well, you're right, they do kind of hate me. I mean, to be a conservative dissident is to open yourself up to a great deal of attack. I mean, we're rhinos, we're all sorts of things, and we come in for a great deal of criticism. And so I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, why, just like that young man down in Miami, why am I in a party that hates me? Why? It doesn't make a bit of sense. And so, you know, it was to me, and that particular dinner was mm-hmm. right about the point in time when Mitt Romney and Donald Trump were kind of playing footsie and winking at each other. And I felt a need to take a public stand to say, you can't have a party that supports those kind of things. You can't have a party that doesn't stand up to people like the birthers and have a guy like me in it. And the consequence, Mitt, of playing with Donald Trump and not calling him out on some of these things is you lose me. And maybe that doesn't factor very high in the political calculus, but it does let me preserve my integrity. And it's a public way of saying I'm not going to be associated with this anymore. And I thought it was important to do.
I've read a lot of your columns, and I really connected with them because I come to politics from a Christian point of view, and it really is the reason why I do get involved. I really try to bring a voice to the poor, and especially for single mothers, and I really appreciated your work on inequality and other topics that I've read about. One thing that I was interested in was I heard that you get some interesting hate mail, and I was told that you once said that you would stay and fight for the soul of the GOP. And I remember feeling that same thing. You know, I was a Republican I from high school on. I got very involved. I was the chairwoman of the Big Stone County Republicans when I had my moment, very similar to yours, when I just realized I couldn't stay if this is what it was going to be like for me. And so, but I did remember feeling like I wanted to stay. I wanted to work within the system and work within the party. And I saw other people who felt the same way, and I really thought that we had a chance. What led you to finally change your mind on that?
Well, I mean, I have an ego just like anybody else, and to be where I am in life, I guess I'm kind of a type A, and people like me hate to admit defeat. I have labored very hard over the past couple of years working with other reform-minded sort of dissident people in the Republican Party, trying to bring it back from the cliff's edge, trying to reconnect with some of those older themes in conservatism, particularly conservation and environmental protection, that legacy that's been kind of pushed to the side, but in other ways as well. We haven't had any success. The counter-narrative that we've tried to put out there has it resonates with some people. Unfortunately, it doesn't resonate with enough people in the Republican Party's base. It has not been successful, and that's a difficult thing. It's almost as if, you know, when in this age of sort of tribal loyalties, particularly when you're invested, you're heavily emotionally invested in politics, knowing when to give up, knowing when to just say enough and walk away, it's a difficult thing. It's like you're at the hospital and somebody you care about is there on the gurney and you want the doctors to keep mm-hmm. working on them. You know, if we just mm-hmm. try one more time, they're going to come back. We can still save them. There's a moment when you have to say no. We can't mm-hmm. save this. Now for me, I have to walk away.
Can you tell us about the moment when you realized for the first time that you really were done? And what was that moment like? Was it, I mean, it sounds like it was a loss. Was it a relief? What happened?
Profound sadness. Profound. I mean, it's a relief in one way, because to be a, quote, rhino, to be a dissident, is to, again, come in for a lot of abuse. And you're almost engaged in this, you know, like in Hamlet, where he's staring at York's skull and debating back and forth. Am I going to do the deed? Am I not going to do it? Am I going to leave? Am I going to stay? And the mind, your mind conjures up. I mean, look, it's like being in an abusive relationship. It's bad, but it's familiar. And we have a tendency in life to stay with the known. And you get stuck in a rut, you're going to stay with what's familiar. Being a dissident in the GOP right now is like being in an abusive marriage. That's really probably the best analogy for it, because you're constantly
wow.
being told how horrible you are. You're constantly having, you're constantly under attack. But when you say, you know what, I'm leaving, oh, how dare you? You're supposed to stay. You're supposed to be part of the team. How dare you? And then the cycle repeats. But your mind, the mind will conjure 100 reasons to stay. And it's how to put it. There's a Spanish author, and his name completely escapes me at the moment. But he was writing about the period right before the Spanish Civil War. And he said, people who had premonitions didn't dare believe them because fear rejects what intuition accepts. That thought was sort of the place where I was, where, you know, I knew that this was going down a very dark and dangerous road that I didn't necessarily want to be a part of. But you don't want to concede it. You don't want to believe it. You don't want to admit that you failed and that something really is past saving at this point. But eventually, you get to a moment where it's to be part of a political party right now is to be, in a sense, part of a tribe. I don't listen to the conservative talk radio hosts. I don't watch Fox News. I don't share in its mythology. I don't cheer for its champions. I'm not part of the tribe. And it was just time to say goodbye and move on to the next chapter politically for me.
Were you worried about the reaction of your family, friends, colleagues to your decision? And how have those conversations gone with the people that you're closest to?
I wasn't that worried about it, because anybody who's read, I'm very public about where I stand on most issues, and anybody who's read my writing kind of knows the approach that I'm taking. The people who would hate me for something like that befriended me on Facebook, you know, many years ago. So, they're already long gone. They're gone. In terms of my circle of friends who are more active in politics, I mean, look, it's the consistent message that I've gotten is, you know, if I wasn't thinking about running for office, if I wasn't in a job that was dependent on access to the Hill, or that was tied in with some way with my political affiliation, you know, we'd do exactly what you did. And I'm blessed in the sense that, you know, these op-ed columns, that's a hobby. Some people play with toy planes. Some people build model railroads. My hobby is writing op-ed columns on the weekends. So I don't get paid for any of that. That's all for free. It's not my career. It's not my job. And I can do whatever political affiliation I want. It's not going to change my life one bit. I knew a long time ago I was never going to run for office. I wasn't going to subject my family to what you have to go through to be involved in politics in that kind of a way. So I wasn't really giving up that much. There are a lot of people who are in positions where they're either in office or they're thinking about running for office or their livelihood is some way sort of tied into their political affiliation who, you know, deep in their heart of hearts, if they could leave, they would.
Is that because of the run-in that the Republicans in Delaware had with Christine O'Donnell? Or...
Well, you know, it's ironic. You know, Christine didn't drive me out of the party. Mitt Romney did. I left now, not back then. O'Donnell, how to put it, that was a unique aberration. I mean, it definitely highlighted how irresponsible the conservative movement has become. And when I say irresponsible, I mean not thoroughly vetting candidates, not looking behind sort of the facade, the Potemkin Village facade of, oh, you know, lower taxes, the government's bad, Obamacare is evil, you know, not looking behind those slogans and examining the actual policies of the person that's uttering them. And unserious, too, in the sense of we're going to send this person who has very limited life experiences down to D.C. to do what? You know, what in their background prepares them to meet the very serious challenges that we have down there? So, yes, I was definitely no fan of O'Donnell. And that Civil War, it was eye-opening for me in the sense of that was my first real sort of face-to-face moment with the national sort of what we might put in, you know, air quotes, the conservative movement, the well-funded Tea Party groups, the Fox News talking heads, you know, Sean Hannity, who was constantly blasting Congressman Castle and supporting Christine. That was my first real, you know, encounter with them. And it was an ugly thing to behold. And you sit there and you say, well, I'm not one of these people. The talking heads on TV are very irresponsible. They want to make a buck. A lot of the activists are not particularly well informed, or they're very they're driven by very, very deep anger. And for me, I come from a different place. I come from love. You know, I don't look at your most left wing liberal and see an enemy who wants to, you know, destroy my country. I see a brother and a sister who I just happen to disagree with. And I'm savvy enough to know that even though we disagree about maybe X, Y, and Z, there's going to be an issue we can work together on. And so on that issue, I'm willing to put the rest aside to get something done. That mentality is completely gone from the conservative movement. I mean, it's very black, white, you know, good guy, bad guy, us versus them kind of thinking. And that's just not, it's just not how I operate. I can't do it.
That's so interesting. You know, I had my run-in with the big, air quote, conservative movement during the Coleman-Wellstone campaign. And okay. I was a Republican at the time, and it was ugly. It was very ugly. The day that Wellstone's plane went down, before we knew whether or not he was and his family were dead or alive, I was called and told, get out there, get your lit drops done, make your phone calls. We got to get as much information out now because we're going to have to be on hold for a few days. And I just thought, I'm sorry, I don't have time. I am praying right now.
Yes.
You can call someone else. There is a man who was on an airplane with staffers and his family, and we might disagree on things, but he was just as dedicated to our state as anybody else, if not more so. And I couldn't believe the ugliness that day that I witnessed, and that was really my moment when I just said, okay, I'm done, and I resigned my post. But, you know, it's a hard moment to come to because you do invest so much. And, you know, I wonder, it's when you say that your friends, you know, who are invested more deeply, you know, they almost envy you. In your piece, Conservatives are Hitting Rock Bottom, you write in regards to today's conservatism that it's angry, cruel, and sneering. It's exemplified by the carnival barkers on talk radio and Fox News, high in volume but devoid of substance. It has no long-term future because it lacks credible solutions to the range of very real problems American society is facing. Well, I couldn't agree with that more, but do you really believe that we are witnessing the end of the conservatism that we associate with Fox News and our current GOP?
No, not at all. I think it's going to get worse. I think it's going to get much worse. And the reason is that it is tied to very deep economic and racial fears and anxieties. And the people who use that as an engine to generate, you know, foot soldiers or votes or whatever you want to call it, are going to be able to ratchet that up. I mean, if you think about the growing inequality in this country and our failure to do anything about it, take for example the Tea Party. I mean, the Tea Party is, at the end of the day, sort of middle America or blue-collar America's ghost dance, isn't it? I mean, they're out there dancing in colonial garb, hoping for the jobs to come back and the factories to reopen, and a world that's gone, that's maybe in some ways 20 years gone, to come back. It's a very it's an interesting phenomenon when you think about it that way. But that economic loss, that insecurity, I mean, when you live in a world, people need to know how they're going to provide for themselves when they're retired. They need to have some level of certainty in their lives financially, in terms of their employment. And when you're in a situation where jobs just disappear overnight, people's savings are wiped out, people are facing, you know, long periods of unemployment, their retirement accounts are being drawn down, their houses are not worth what they paid for them. And you look at the report that came out, I think, just a couple of weeks ago, talking about 40% of middle class America's wealth was wiped out in the crash. I mean, that's huge. It's huge, and it creates a great deal of insecurity. And then the other thing with the conservative movement, I mean, people don't want to hear this, but there is a racial component to it. There's a reason why the conservative movement is 90-some percent Caucasian. And as you look at America, there's a sense of cultural and social insecurity that sort of feeds into the economic grievances among a lot of people who are in that movement. And as you look at America's future becoming much more diverse, there are people who are threatened by those kind of changes. And you know, I can't help when I hear that, you know, we want our country back. I hear it against that background, you know, that background and that backdrop of sort of a changing cultural America. And I don't know if those grievances, I don't see anything that's going to make them get better. You know, a Mitt Romney presidency, what is he going to do for middle-class America economically? What's he going to do for the blue-collar workers? Is he going to bring the jobs back? Is he going to bring health care benefits back? Is he going to bring pensions back? I don't see it. So I think as long as those, you know, when you talk about the wellsprings of that fear and that anger and that anxiety, I don't see anything being done that's going to eliminate the springs that are feeding those rivers. And so I tend to think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
And as a result, do you see the conservative movement, the current GOP, declining then?
Possibly. I mean, it's long-term, the Republican Party must do better with particularly Hispanic and Asian American voters in order to remain a viable national party. I could see it being, you know, if, put it this way, if America becomes more like California, do you see the Republican Party moving to a position of permanent opposition, permanent minority status? Possibly. The current version of it, if it doesn't, you know, reform, will eventually get there. I mean, they're going to be losing Texas in a cycle or two if the current trends continue. I don't know if I was a Democrat, I wouldn't necessarily take any great pleasure in that. Number one, the Republican Party has not been particularly responsible in opposition. And I think, you know, we could probably see that trend continue. But more importantly, I think it's a very dangerous situation for America when one of our two major political parties becomes essentially an ethnic, tribal, you know, minority party. And a Republican Party that's shrunk down to just winning elections in the South and maybe the Mountain West and is in permanent opposition to the rest of the country and sees itself separated further and further from other parts of the country culturally and racially and economically, that's a dangerous mix. That's a very dangerous mix for our future. And it's something all people of goodwill should be worried about.
I have two callers who've been holding to ask a question. Would you have time to take their questions?
Yeah, sure.
If not, I completely understand. Okay,
no,
well,
sure,
thank
sure,
you.
Sure. I can do it.
Thanks so much. Okay, first I have a caller in 541, Janine, and 646, I see your hand up as well, so we will get to you next. Janine, are you there?
I'm here, and actually, Michael's answered my questions. I think I'm mostly here in case your phone dies again, Jessica, but the one thing I was curious about was whether or not those 400 emails that Michael got in answer to his announcement had as much compassion for him as he had for his party that he was leaving. I was wondering if those emails had shown you what you were hoping to see from people when they responded to you.
Excellent question.
Excellent question. I can answer that. You know, when you're an author, when you engage in the creative process, you know, it's like you're creating something and you're sending it out there to the world. And some people are going to like it, some people are going to hate it. And more often than not, it's the people that hate it that you hear from. And that's just par for the course with writing. You're hoping always, I think, to touch a couple of people, that if somebody's sitting out there, picks up their newspaper and they read that and they say, you know what, this is true, this is right, this resonates with me, you know, this, you make that connection with one person. That's, to me, that's enough. Well, in this particular case, like I said, probably 350, 380 emails, overwhelmingly positive. Most people, you know, I heard a lot from folks, younger people, younger professional people, who were basically saying, I could have wrote this. This is my life. This is my life experience. This is exactly where I am, you know, emotionally with today's Republican Party. I can't reconcile what I know about the world with their slogans and what they throw out there on Fox News. And I just can't do it anymore. But I got a lot of that. And then, of course, you do get the emails from people saying, you are now my enemy. You know, you're a traitor to America and all that kind of stuff. That's par for the course. A lot of people didn't pick up on the piece was written intentionally to try to capture the difficulty and the sadness of the moment of parting. And because, I mean, this wasn't I went to a Republican meeting, somebody said something I didn't like, and I said, ah, the heck with these people, I'm switching my registration. This was years building, and just you know, a lot of heartache involved in it. And at the very end of the column, where I referenced the line from the old Irish song, that is intended to kind of evoke that, because the song's about sort of the heartache of parting from something that you love. And for, you know, 30-some years of my life, the Republican Party's been something that I love, something I invested a great deal of time and energy into being a part of. And so, yeah, there's a deep sense of sadness in having to come to one of these meetings, but overwhelmingly positive response overall.
Thank you.
646, could you tell us your name and where you're calling from?
My name is Hans Lambert. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, Hans. How are you today?
How are you, Jessica?
I'm doing well. Hans is our guest for the second half of our show. Hans, do you have a question for Michael?
No, I commend Michael for being what I call what a true patriot is in this country. Too often that word has been, the Republican Party has always been a patriot is someone who tends to think in a divisive or secular area. But a true patriot is someone who's actually cared for the country and want to move forward and wants to make sure that everyone in this society, in this country, has their rights taken care of, not just one particular section of the country.
Well, thank you. That means a lot. It really does.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate you joining us today, especially given it's a holiday and your daughter's birthday. It deeply saddens me that you decided a long time ago that you didn't want to run for an office, because your passion, your heart, your incredible ability to think through many of the issues that our country is going through today are exactly what I feel our country needs, no matter what party you end up in. I just wish you the best, and I really appreciate your taking the time today and sharing your story with us here on The Bottom Line.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Good luck, and I was really honored to be a guest today. Take care.
Well, Thank you. You too. And I was so honored to have Michael on. You know, I'm a single mom with four kids living here in St. Paul, Minnesota. Wow. I can't believe I just got to interview him. I appreciate his writing. And I really, because I went through that experience, I empathize deeply with that decision that he made. And so I hope that those of you who joined us today appreciated the conversation. I do have people who have called in. If you've called in and you would like to join our conversation, please press 1. That way you will be entered into the queue. And I do identify callers by your area code. And so if you press 1, please listen for your area code, and I will open up the phone line as soon as I can to take your question or comment. I just have to take a moment after that. today, here on The Bottom Line, we're talking about and celebrating President Obama's announcement on immigration this week. And so that's what we'll be doing for the remaining part of our show. So to begin, I just want to put out an invitation to everyone who's listening to please stay with us and call in and share your family's immigration story. I know that my family has a very interesting pathway to America. I'm sure yours does as well. And I'd love to hear how your family arrived here in America and how they have made the community stronger. But first, I'd like to ask this and paint a picture. Can you imagine growing up in this country from a young age and going to school and serving in your community and making friends and connecting with the culture? And after you graduate and try to navigate adulthood, you begin to think about what you're going to be when you grow up and what you're going to do for a living, and you find yourself locked out. Could you stand by as your value as a human being is diminished and watch your younger siblings and your friends who are born in this country go on to graduate college or work, but you can't for the fact that you were born elsewhere? With little or no ties to your country of origin, you could be faced with deportation, and yet, what would you do? What would you do? Well, I'll draw a line in the sand and say, who among us would be the first person to take a child who was brought here at a young age and deport that young adult or middle-aged adult back to a country where, frankly, they don't belong? Well, thank goodness that is no longer a reality for those young adults who are living in this country who are under the age of 30. Thank goodness that as long as Obama is president, we can continue to invest in those lives and reap the real benefit of documenting those adults. Well, do you agree with me? Give us a call. If you disagree, give me a call. What is your answer to the immigration debate? Please join our conversation at 646-929-2495. Hans Lambert is here with us. He was born in Haiti, and he is now a 51-year-old security manager from Brooklyn, New York. Hans, thank you so much for joining us today and for being willing to share your perspective on Obama's announcement this week.
Oh, thank you, Jessica. I'm delighted to be part of this discussion. This is long overdue, and it's a monumental decision by Mr. Obama. Hopefully that it would lead to better reforms. And as we know, immigration reform is a huge issue in this country. And it's not because you're Republican or a Democrat. It's just good common sense that these young people were educated here, been here a long time, and they are Americans, so to speak. So I commend Mr. Obama for finally taking a step in the right direction.
I do too, and that's why we're celebrating it here today on The Bottom Line. Coffee Party is a transpartisan party, and I do realize that, but I am a progressive-leaning person, and so that's why I am saying that I'm celebrating this decision and why I'm opening up the show for people to call in and tell us your family's immigration story and tell us how your family has contributed here to our nation. I've invited Hans on today to talk about his own story about immigrating here from Haiti at the age of 10. And I hope that you'll join us at 646-929-2495. Please press 1 if you would like to join the conversation, and if you have any questions or comments, we invite all viewpoints. This isn't just a show for liberals or Democrats or whatever. This is a show for everybody, and this is an issue, like Hans was saying and like Michael Stafford was saying, that is affecting everybody in this country. And for a long time, this wasn't a partisan issue. This was an issue that, President Bush attempted to remedy, that people from all backgrounds want to find a solution on. So if you have a point of view perspective, please give us a call. And in the meantime, Hans, do you mind sharing with us how your family or how you came to America?
Absolutely. I cannot fathom of anyone coming here and being undocumented. Luckily for my family, my father was able to come in years earlier before he was able to apply for us. But as you know, so many other Haitians in that time was not as lucky. Some of them was coming in by boat. Some of them was coming in by any forms, coming here on vacation and staying. But my experience is mainly through friends that have been coming here and pretty much undocumented. And I saw their despair, how they really wanted to stay here and work and make their life better. I mean, one of the biggest misconceptions is that people who migrated here it's just here to take people's jobs and stuff like that. But this is America. America's always been a land of immigrants, a land of opportunity. And the same people, the naysayers, are saying, well, they're coming here to take the jobs. They don't realize their forefathers, their grandfathers, were immigrants themselves. So they're pretty much turning... Hello?
Yep, I'm here. I was just agreeing with you.
Yeah, they're pretty much turning their backs on their forefathers with that type of mentality. But then again, there's more to it. When it comes to immigration in America, as far as the racism issue, sometimes I think had it been, let's say, if in the Mexican border, let's say it was Europeans coming up from the Mexican border, or Europeans coming from the Caribbean and Central America and South America, would be so-called conservatives be against that?
That's interesting. My family came from Germany about 150 years ago, and they were given free land, which we stole from the natives, free education, and free opportunity. They faced discrimination, especially during World War II, because they were German and there were internment camps. But Monsanto wouldn't have a pot to you-know-what in if it weren't for the U.S. immigration policies that brought my ancestors out to the plains of Minnesota. And they wouldn't have stayed if it hadn't been for their hard work. I mean, they had to stay on this land for a year and cultivate it and tear up the prairie grass. It was hard work. And how is that any different from any other situation? I mean, I've heard all kinds of fantasies that people are coming here so they can live high on the hog on welfare. But let me tell you, I'm a welfare mom. Nobody's living high on the hog on welfare. You saw how much food I get from the food shelf, and I have to go to the food shelf because the helps and supports in this country are not what some people crack them up to be, okay? So what is really behind that argument, right? I mean, about jobs. I do have a caller, 610, that I want to invite into the conversation. 610, where are you from, and what's your name?
Bethlehem, Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'm Bob Trotner. I'm local coffee party organizer out here.
Hi, Bob. How are you today?
All right, good. I think I remember you also from the Enough is Enough rally that we had last year in October. Didn't you speak in that snowstorm?
I did. That's actually how I got so involved, and I wouldn't be talking to you now if I hadn't gone. Yes, that was a day to remember.
Oh yeah.
Well,
oh,
what
yeah.
would you like to share with us today?
Well, first of all, I wanted to, I wanted to say how much I enjoyed the first caller, Michael Stafford. I think what he's saying is something that should be said. I hope he joins the coffee party out in California. I hope he joins us. But I think he had a lot of good things to say. And the other thing I wanted to say is my family on my mother's side came over 1924, just after, not too long after they required in other words, in the old days, you just come over. You know, you didn't need any papers or any permission or anything. You just came over in a boat. And then they started to limit immigration, I guess, about 1910 or something. But before that, you just took a boat and you came here. You know, you didn't need a passport or I can't remember the name of the doc. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to apply for citizenship status or anything, whatever they call it. But, and we were lucky we came over because they were cutting off immigration. And if my family wouldn't have come over in 1923, it would still have been in Lithuania when the Holocaust hit. So, I'm very blessed to be in this country. I may not have ever been born. So
wow.
That's the first thing. Well, I mean, it's the same as any immigrant story. And I believe in what your guest is saying 100%. I understand a little bit about President Obama's initiative, but I didn't get the whole thing. What about the parents? I mean, does this just apply to the kids? And what happens are the parents with the kids or are the kids on their own?
Hans, do you want to speak to that?
I'm confident that this new initiative is a stepping stone. It's the beginning of
mm-hmm.
reform, and I'm really confident that within a few years that we will get further, and things will get better as far as leeway as far as citizenship and documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, as I understand it, it isn't amnesty and there isn't a pathway built into this legislation for the Dreamers. By Dreamer, I mean children who were brought here by their parents. I've not heard anything about their parents being offered any kind of work visa or ability to have a pathway to mm-hmm. citizenship. What this does allow is for those kids to go to school, to serve in the military, to stay in this country and not face the threat and the instability of deportation, especially for those who have lived here their whole lives and don't even know their own language. The picture I painted at the beginning of the show is a picture that until this week, those kids faced. I mean, I've heard documentaries on National Public Radio of young Latina woman who talked about and very eloquently shared her story about how she made straight A's and listened to her teachers and did everything she was told in school so that she could get into college. And it wasn't until after she graduated did she find out that she wasn't documented. And so she watched as her sister went on to college and became a doctor.
Wow.
And she was just hamstrung. There was nothing she could do. And so I think the announcement, the policy that Obama has enacted this week is to address those very people, but they have to be under the age of 30. So, what happens if you're 31, and I do agree with you, Hans, this has to be a stepping stone because it is going to lead to more questions. And until we have a permanent solution to immigration and for all those families who are in America, who are working, contributing their hard work, we really do need to find a solution. Bob, do you have any ideas on immigration?
I don't have any earth-shattering ideas. I think what I've heard, I mean, President Bush proposed it, and President Obama supported it, and I think basically the path to citizenship seems to be the most reasonable way to go, because, like I said, I don't have any earth-shattering ideas, but that seems very reasonable. That's what we sort of tried to do, I guess it was in 1986, or at some point in the past, we had an amnesty for people. And now I just think we have to do it again, because the whole economy is based on it, and there are low-level jobs that are part of the economy that people do, that immigrants do, that Americans won't do. There are so high-level jobs that immigrants, not immigrants, but undocumented aliens do, that need to be done in the economy. And you can't, it's just unreal to think you're going to deport them. But I don't have any other, I just think, you know, I don't know, unless Hans has other ideas, it just seems like that's the most reasonable way to go. It's the idea of putting them on a path to citizenship, and if they meet certain requirements, they become citizens.
Sure.
I mean,
there are requirements within this that you can't, that are directed towards these kids, and young adults. They can't have gotten into any kind of criminal trouble or have a history, and they must have gone to school, and I believe they had to have been here before this week. So this isn't going to apply to people who come now, next week or the next week. This only applies to children who are already here, and young adults who are already here. So I do know those are some of the requirements that have been put in place. Mm-hmm. And also these children are still not going to have a voice. They're going to pay taxes now. They're going to, and they have been. They've been paying sales tax and other taxes, property tax. But now, you know, they're going to be paying taxes on their income as well. And, you know, that for me raises some real issues, because our country was founded on the idea of not having taxation without representation.
Sure, exactly. And while you were talking, I was thinking of something else. And is Hans still there? Or?
Yes,
Hans.
Yes,
I am.
Okay, because while you were talking, something else occurred to me. And you were saying how one of the requirements was they can't have a juvenile record or a criminal record, that type of thing. It occurs to me that throughout our history, immigrant families often, or undocumented, documented, whatever, often the kids have trouble with the law. That's just the fact of the way they're brought up and the way they live, and the fact that it's an underground, whole underground society. And I'm wondering if, you know, I mean, throughout our history, it's been that way. I mean, every immigrant that came over, you know, they had the gangs and this and that.
Sure.
And I'm just not so sure that, you know, I can understand how it's politically palatable to make that a requirement, but I'm just thinking to myself how that maybe to a certain extent is unrealistic. If we're really going to design a good bill, you know, not saying whether it could pass or not, I don't know if that's really a fair requirement, because there's probably so many people, so many kids in that situation that have a juvenile or criminal record just because of the circumstances of, you know, if you're an immigrant family, whether you're documented or not, you know, the kids are going to form gangs and stuff like that. That's a very natural consequence of poverty and a whole lot of other things. So maybe you could comment on that. I'm not so sure that's really fair, put it that way.
I completely agree with you, because their kids are under some certain social conditions that, you know, that this may affect. I mean, depending on their background and their, like you said, the way they were brought up. But I do understand why they have these requirements. You know, they want the most talented people, the most progressive people, You know, they want our, you know, future outstanding citizens for this country. And I understand that, but I do understand you, Bob, for saying that there are people that's going to be, it's going to be unfairly, I mean, a kid gets in trouble, let's say somewhere in East L.A. and is in a poverty-ridden section of the country. You know, I can see exactly where you're coming from, Bob, that he's vulnerable for some kind of act, criminal activity, I guess.
I guess the idea may be what Jessica said to begin with, you have to start somewhere. And once you make a start somewhere, you can always, you know, you can always improve things. You know, maybe it's only between 15 and 30 now, and somebody 31, they'll be excluded, or they came to the country the day after the, you know, a day too late. But at least you have a start, I guess. I guess that's the important thing, to start to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm. I'm back, guys. Sorry about that.
What's that?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
This country has a history of, from the civil rights movement to any kind of movement, that they've always, decisions were made early on. It seems like it's not enough at the time, but eventually it's more like taking baby steps. You know, you crawl and you have to stand up and you have to walk. And I think this is where this immigration reform thing is coming to. I think if this administration is elected again, I see we'll see further progress within the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that'd be terrific. That would be, to have real progress within the next 4 years is a heck of a goal that's worth shooting for. I hope that the forces of reaction aren't so strong that it takes longer than 4 years. I just hope, you know, as we say, from your mouth to God's ears, I hope that's true.
Hans,
of course,
how do you...
if Romney gets elected, it's not going to happen at all, I don't think.
That was my question for Hans. Hans, what do you think will happen if Romney's elected and if this is turned back?
I would hate to think of that, but since you asked the questions, it would definitely be a step back. But as far as the immigration issue goes, I think they would have to deal with it. It's something America must deal with. It's not something that you can ignore. And I think for their future of their party, they'll have to address that and have to do quick reformations. But I don't think it would be as great as it would be under Obama administration, though.
Mm-hmm. In your community there in New York, do you think you'll be seeing the repercussions of this legislation? Are you already hearing from friends and family who are celebrating with us today?
The only thing I heard as far as this new executive order is that some people feel, maybe, what if they're not given a work permit? What if the government knows where they are and things didn't work out? Now they can be deported. So they need more assurances as far as where this is going to.
Wow. So maybe our celebration today is a little preemptive. You know, I was wondering that very thing because, you know, people will be found out, won't they?
Absolutely.
For your situation, your father came here. How many years was he here working before the family was able to join him?
I'd say about 4 years.
Wow. And so from the time that you were about 6 years old, your dad was here in the U.S., and it was you and your mom, and did you have any siblings at the time?
Absolutely. I had two brothers. Actually, my mother had the opportunity of coming with my father, but she would not leave us behind. So, which means that my father had to come here and work, and then eventually apply for all of us. And which he came in 67, and eventually we came in 71.
Wow. Do you feel in any way? I know I've some friends who've immigrated here, and they went through all of the steps, and it was very costly. They had to find a sponsor, and it cost a lot of money for them to become citizens. The funny thing is, though, I mean, you would think that people who've gone through all of the steps and the processes might be a little bit annoyed that others who came here without going through all that are now receiving this chance to work. But I've not seen that. Is that sentiment at all taking place in the community of people who've immigrated here legally?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. People are happy that finally this government is taking steps, these great steps in helping these people. Because people have no idea leaving a family behind and you have to come here and work. Sometimes a lot of these people, whether they're Mexican, Haitian, Salvadorian, Guatemalan, they have to really come here to work and save and live in boarding houses and just to save enough money to get their family here. So it's a work in itself. A few years ago, I saw a movie called El Norte, The North. And it was about immigrants trying to get from Guatemala into Mexico into the United States. And it's a very moving piece that where you see the human side of the story, where our human beings are looking for a better way of life. Really incredible.
Wow. I think I might have seen that. Yeah. And I do have family who immigrated here from Peru and Mexico, and family through my marriage. They're not my ex-in-laws, but we're still family. You know, they're my kids' uncles and cousins, and so, you know, once you see the human side of the story, it's very hard to imagine being in that position, and it's frustrating to have it become such a political issue, where now it seems like it's going to be such a huge fight to provide any kind of pathway to citizenship for people who are illegal. And it's frustrating because a lot of people come here illegally because they can't afford the time and the money that's involved in becoming a citizen in the United States. It really is, you know, the original, you know, 99% situation where, you know, when you're struggling to survive and you're really trying to survive, and then, you know, it just seems like a frustrating situation to put people through. And so I hope that our country can really find a human solution to this very human problem, a humane solution to this human problem. So we have a half an hour left in the show, and there are several people who have called in to listen to the show. If you'd like to join our discussion, please raise your hand by pressing 1, and I'll identify you by your area code. And if you'd like to share your family's immigration story, that's what we're opening up the phone lines to do today. And tell us how your family has made this country stronger. And maybe some of the, if you know the details of how your family came to this country. Hans Lambert has joined us, and his family is from Haiti. And I know that this country is made up of all kinds of people from all over the world. So please call us and share your story today. It's 646-929-2495. And also let us know how you feel about the president's announcement. Do you feel like this is going to make sense? Do you feel like we're preemptively celebrating here? Let us know your point of view and how this is going to affect your life and your family and your community. So, Hans, I've invited everybody else to tell us how their family has contributed. How do you feel that your community, Haitian community, has contributed and your family in general?
Well, in the Haitian community, something just occurred a few years ago because of the earthquake in Haiti. Some amnesty was given just to people that was already here because of the earthquake. So it took a disaster for the government to enact that order, that some Haitians that were here during the earthquake had no place to go, actually, so they decided to give them a some form of way to stay here and given document to work.
Wow. Did that make it easier for some of, did you personally know anybody who was affected by that?
Oh, actually, yes. I do know two people that was here for years, and they were pretty much, they were happy, but at the same time, they were distressed to say, wow, it took a disaster in Haiti for the government to finally give them an opportunity to stay and try to work on their paperwork.
Hmm.
But unfortunately, it took an earthquake to do that.
Wow. It must be so frustrating. I mean, and this is just my progressive point of view, and I'm sure there are people who would disagree with me, but it seems that, you know, when it comes to our neighbors in the southern border, a lot of our economic policies, and for that matter, even ag people, agricultural people to the north, it seems like a lot of our policies, you know, really hamstring some of these countries and make it difficult to provide their citizens with the kind of work and the kind of opportunity that we have here in America. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, this is where the race issue always come up to me, because most of these people are people of color. And I think there's a segment of America that does not want the face of America to change. Culturally, even as one of the speakers alluded to earlier, culturally, they're not prepared for these changes. Middle America, they want a particular America. But the reality of it is America is changing. There's a lot of new faces, and they don't want any more of these faces. That's the way it looks to me. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but that's the way it looks to me.
I know we have Janine here. She is also a host of a radio show's Coffee Party, and she's been my co-pilot on the show. And Janine, do you have anything you'd like to add to our conversation?
Well, certainly I have a story as well. I'm very interested in Hans's story, and I was glad to hear, I think I heard, Hans, that your family was safe and well, your family in Haiti, and I think we all sort of held our breath for a long time after the earthquake. So my family, I think I'm a pretty typical American in the sense that, I was born in Oregon. My mother was born in Oregon. My mother's father was born in Oregon. My mother's father's father was born in Oregon. And it actually probably goes farther back than that, because we have roots with Native Americans here. And so a lot of us actually connect all the way back to the first people. So part of me says, yes, I've been here a long time. And yet there's other parts of me, you know, who are more recently come to this country. And so I have no illusions that it is more my country than it's Hans's country. And maybe that makes me different than some people, you know, because whether I am 8 generations American or first generation American, I think we've all chosen to be here and to stay here and to be American. And I think that's important. I think it's a very important distinction. But yeah, one side Italian, then Norwegian, another piece, Scott and German, you know, what are we? We're the American melting pot. And a little piece. But I think the funniest part is, you know, my father's mother was English, you know, of English descent, and she claimed a little heritage back to the Mayflower. And I have married a man who is very documentably connected back to the Mayflower, and also has a family who signed the Declaration of Independence. So there you go. You know, here's my American story. So I guess there's a contribution there, but I so see the importance of us all. And I hope one thing that happens from what President Obama has done is that maybe we can stop looking at each other and wondering whether or not we're documented, you know, and actually start seeing the potential in one another. I'm sorry you had to do this by executive order. I was hoping this could happen through Congress, but they apparently are gridlocked on this, and so he had to act alone. And that's
The frustrating part is that Congress has, the House, I believe, passed the DREAM Act. And then it got stalled in the Senate, and there was a filibuster. Or maybe, no, I'm sorry, it might be the other way around. Anyway, in one of the two, either the Senate or the House, it got stuck because it had enough votes to pass in both houses, but there was a Republican filibuster of the DREAM Act. And so that for me was the frustrating part. And the DREAM Act, of course, did have a path to citizenship, and this executive order does not. I echo your sentiment, Janine. I mean, where do we come from? You know, if you've studied American or European history, I found it fascinating to see how, because of the division in the Catholic Church with the Lutheran Church, over a course of 200 years, you know, there were Norwegians moving all over the place, to France, to Germany, Germans moving to Norway, people running and fleeing from religious war. And yet, it's 200 years later, and if you go to Sweden, you don't hear somebody say, well, we're Swedish, but we came from such and such and such and such. Or, you know, we're Irish, but we came from such and such and such. They just say, I'm Irish. And so after 2001, for me, I was just like, okay, that's it, I'm American. You know, because I have my German family on my mom's side. And on my dad's side, you know, that family, the English family, they came over and you know, early on, and they were in the first colony in Jamestown, or not the very first colony, but that's where they came to. And one of them was in the House of Burgess. And so, you know, they fought in the Revolutionary War. Brother fought against brother on my dad's side. And then Ebenezer English ended up going to the South after the Civil War, or before the Civil War, and ended up fighting family against family during that. So we have a very divided family. But it's interesting just to see, you know, when to ask that question, well, where do we come from? You know, it seems like, you know, that it's becoming less and less of an issue for a lot of us, because a lot of us think of ourselves as American. We all want to come together and work together to make this country stronger. And I think that this immigration issue is really about investing in people. And there's a lot of people who want to deny that life doesn't happen. And, you know, 15 years ago, if you told me that the man I was in love with was going to marry me, I was going to have four children, and then one day I was going to want a divorce, I would have just been like, what? You know? But those things do happen, and you know, poverty can happen to anybody in this country. Just ask all the bankers who have been laid off in the past few years, you know. I used to have a 5-bedroom house, too. And so, you know, if we really want to create a land of opportunity, if we really want to live up to that American dream that we've always heralded and those liberties that we've fought for and that our fathers and our mothers fought for, I think that we have to let go of the racism that has divided our country. And because it's almost like the religious warfare that divided Europe back in the 1800s and 1700s. And so, I don't know, that's my hope for this beginning step, this baby step, like Hans said. Hans, what are your hopes for the immigration debate?
Well, I hope cooler heads will prevail. Common sense will definitely prevail, and people have to realize this is the United Nations. Really, this is what the United States is. It's the United Nations of America, and it stands for opportunity, land of liberty, and if you want to be associated with that, then you'd have to come to your senses and say, these are people that's coming for better opportunities. They just like when America wants to go anywhere else in the world and do business, and it's the same way people want to come to America and try to better their lives. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's just the way. That's the evolution of man, really. Like you mentioned the War of Independence. I don't know if you know Haitians fought in the War of Independence, and you know
I did not know that.
Yes, they did. There's a statue in Georgia erected because if you recall General Lafayette, the French general, when the French came in the aid of the Americans, there was a lot of Haitian soldiers with them. Haiti at the time being a colony of France. So.
Wow.
So American history has a lot, not just Haitians, but people from the south of the border who fought in the American Revolutionary War, who fought for the independence of the United States. You know, so there's a long history of that. And I think a lot of these conservatives today who pretty much they just want to be putting themselves in a category. They're not seeing the bigger picture, the human side of the picture, that this is America. America stands for all nations, and that's why I've made this country so great, because of its, you know, if its diversity. And there's only one true American, really. And mm-hmm. we all know it, it's the American Indian. So, if we know what happened to them, so that's a long story, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, this phone call's been so interesting because I have a storm rolling overhead and I keep getting dropped from the conversation. So I missed a little bit of part of your story. So I apologize for that. And if I sound like I've been disjointed, it's because I half the time I'm trying to call back into the show.
But
you know, it's really striking when you were talking about the disaster that occurred in Haiti that finally allowed people who had been here for how many years to finally be able to come out and say, I'm here. And are those friends of yours able to vote now? Do you feel like they're more engaged in politics, and are they trying to be involved when it comes to this kind of policy?
Well, absolutely. One of them is just can't wait to finally get his citizenship one day, so he can be able to vote and be part of the process. Because these people, they paid attention to. I mean, they're not just here in this country and not paying attention to the political issues, and they're emotional and they're very, you know, distressed about certain things that goes on, and also they can't wait to participate in the process.
Well, that'll be excellent. I'm excited for them as well. It's very exciting to be able to be involved in our self-governance, in the process of self-governance, and I feel very frustrated that there are people who are locked out, and it is frustrating to me when Bob brought up the fact that there are people who are not going to be covered under this new executive order, people who've been caught up in crime. You know, as we all know, poverty is the number one indicator for becoming involved in crime or being prosecuted unfairly or falsely for a crime. And so, you know, it just seems like a no-brainer that if we want to, you know, end some of the crime in this country, that it seems counterintuitive to then continue to have laws that keep people out of the legal process and keep people out of being a part of their own democracy. So I really hope that your friend is able to vote and able to join in. and that other kids too, especially young people, all these young people who are under the age of 30, that is such an exciting time in life to be involved, and you have so much more energy, and a lot of times you don't have kids, so you can go to debates and join in. Since you've been in the country, did your brothers stay? Did your family all stay in Haiti, and have more of your family come from Haiti since you've been here?
Oh, absolutely. More of my family's cousins eventually came over. You know, and some of them did go back. I mean, to I have a cousin; she's over there teaching now. You know, she graduated from here, and she's teaching school in Haiti. You know, she wants, you know, she wants to contribute, you know, to Haiti. Absolutely.
Wow. Was she there when the earthquake hit?
Oh, actually no. She wasn't there, but she did fly to the Dominican Republic about 2 days later and actually went in there and helped out.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Wow. So for your family, now that you've been here in this country, and do you have kids of your own?
Oh, absolutely. I have two sons.
Oh, happy Father's Day. I'm sorry.
thank you. And then my wife isn't from Panama, actually. She's from Colón, Panama.
Nice. Yes, I actually have a friend here in Minnesota. Her name is Kathy Colway, and she's been on the show before, and she is actually the person who connected me to you, and I know her husband is from Panama. Is that how you are connected?
That's my wife's oldest son, actually.
Ah, nice. Okay, I understand now. Wonderful. Well, I know her son, and he is fabulous. So is her grandson. He's one of my daughter's good friends. Oh, it's so great to make the connections here, you guys, on the bottom line, and to see how people come together to talk about politics, to talk about policies that are affecting real human beings and our real lives, the way that our country can invest in people. And, you know, imagine it, like I told you in my story of my German immigrants, you know, the German side of my family, they came here, they were given free land, as long as they could farm it, and free opportunities. Can you imagine if the government had said, okay, well, you know, Johanna Schmidt, and I don't know my great-grandfather's name, I feel terrible not knowing, but Johanna Schmidt, your daughter Anna Schmidt is going to be deported because she came over here with you and you guys have farmed here for the last 10 years, but she's undocumented, and so we're deporting her back to Germany. I mean, the idea of it is laughable. And that is exactly... Go ahead.
You're absolutely correct. It's laughable.
We wouldn't even consider it, right? Because, I mean, my great-great-grandmother my great-great-grandmother was educated in the schools here. She learned English, and she became a farmer and married a farmer, and her children were all educated here. And my great-grandmother, Anna, who changed her name to Anne during World War II, she was born here as well and educated here as well. And yet, you know, that doesn't seem like a big deal at all. But if somebody comes here from Mexico or from South America or another country, it seems like we have a completely different point of view, you know? And yet when it's like we're denying the history. I mean, when did, you know, if we hadn't had the immigration policy that we had back in the 1800s, like I said before, Monsanto wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have the big agricultural behemoths that we have in this country today.
Exactly.
Well, Jessica, I just have to interrupt and remind you that not everybody feels this way. But the people who make a lot of noise feel this way. And I would assert that they're probably the same people that when they draw pictures of Jesus, they make him a blonde. And, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. What we can do, though, is not be quiet when they do this. You know, not tolerate ethnic or racial slurs, not tolerate any kind of bullying that of any kind, but certainly any kind that points to any kind of racial discrimination. And that doesn't matter if you're legal or not legal, documented or not documented. That's really any kind of racial bigotry. You know, so You know, I feel pretty strongly about this. I graduated from high school, you know, 45 years ago. It's a long time. There were a lot of people in my graduating class with Latino last names. I promise you, they were citizens then. Their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren are all legal citizens, and yet in the last 10 years, they're looked at as though they were new. And they're not new. I mean, I'm on the West Coast, right? I mean, a stone throw from here used to be Mexico. So I'm a little uncomfortable with the whole notion that we've grown to accept any of this intolerance as though it were somehow always true, because it's not always been true. I promise you, 45 years ago at McNary High School in Salem, Oregon, there were lots of people with those kinds of names. We didn't think a thing of it, and they are all fine. So I think starting with just being intolerant of that kind of bigotry is where we need to begin. So I'm sorry, I'm off my soapbox now, but I feel so strongly about this. It's become fashionable. It's become fashionable, and I can't be with it, you know. Jessica, you're back.
I'm back. Sorry, guys.
And now I'm the time.
Well, it sounded great, Janine. It sounded great, and you know, it brings me to the point of, you know, when people use the economic argument that people are coming here to steal jobs or to take jobs, or to take government programs.
Oh, forget about it.
It's just maddening. I mean.
Well, if I can give 2 cents on this, I was an employer. I owned a company. I had 40 employees. People who give jobs to people who they cannot document are committing felonies. And if we go after anybody for that, we should go after employers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think it puts the employers in a really crappy position. I mean, imagine if the country had that kind of position 150 years ago. Would we have all these companies, like I said, all these big agricultural companies, would we have become the breadbasket of America, of the world?
Back up one second. Here's the deal. Sure. When you go away, you bring in guest workers, you keep them for 2 years and then lose them. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but big business has brought many people here. You know, when they could have staffed that factory with Americans, when they could have built those subdivisions with Americans, when they could, I mean, I tell you, the entire Southwest was built with guest workers. The entire housing boom in the Southwest was built with guest workers that disappeared before they went home. So this is big money making profit at the expense of these people. Mm. And, I mean, it's just a piece of the puzzle. But who got in trouble for that? You know, the people who had babies that 2 years. Yes. And their wives. Their wives who were good Catholics and had children in those 2 years while they were here. And they called them anchor babies. No, I call them love children. But again, I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, thanks for helping me out today. Janine helped me out in a pinch, you guys, on last-minute notice. And so, especially for a holiday, too. I mean, I really appreciate it, especially with the storm that rolled through. I lost my call, I don't know, 6 or 7 times. So it's been hard to even be a coherent part of this conversation. But thank you very much for your help. And I'm really appreciative of Hans Lambert, who took the time to call in today. Thank you, Hans. I appreciate it so much for your perspective.
Thank you.
It was great to have you on the show. And I'm sorry that I wasn't more present here today, but it was great to hear your story. Janine, I know you're going to close us out today, and so I'll go ahead and say goodbye to everybody. Please join us again next week. It will be another excellent conversation. Hopefully more people can call in, and we can continue to have civil discourse and educate each other on these issues.
Thanks, Jessica. And I just want to thank all of you, the listeners, the members, the volunteers, and followers of Coffee Party USA. We are totally membership-driven. If you'd like to financially support the technology behind our social media or the micro staff that wrangles the efforts of these wild and crazy volunteers, go to coffeepartyusa.com, click on Donate, then click on either Become a Member or Renew Your Membership, or join me and click on Sustaining Membership. We love our members. You are everything to us. and without you, we are nothing. With that, I'm signing out. This is Janine Mouden. Thank you so much, Jessica. It has been so much fun to be on the Bottom Line with you today. Coffee party on.